Yo, welcome to Transfin Long Shots. This is Nikhil Arora and I have with me the usual suspect, the Sharad Tupran. I always add the next to Sharad because that's what he deserves. What do you say, Sharad? How's it going?
Going good. Another day, another dollar. I'm looking forward to our chat today and looking for ways to make money.
I'm particularly excited about, you know, this episode. I mean, it's not just a new episode. It's practically a new season. We have been in hibernation for a couple of weeks. And I think it's a mix of part strategic rethinking of how to look at long shots going forward, as well as, I think, partial laziness. But, as you all know, we typically, like to deconstruct businesses, or at least try to understand the journey of founders, of business leaders, in general, cover a fair bit of ground. We talk about business models. We talk about sectoral views. We talk about, how founders view regulators, how founders view investment ecosystems. But in this season, I think the idea is to focus on a specific aspect of the journey, right? Being what makes a business interesting from an investor standpoint. Because I think when we kind of meet founders, entrepreneurs, they are surrounded by the operational heavy lifting of setting up what they have set up. And when we meet investors, they obviously are those set of guys who are bombarded with opportunities every second day. And hence they have some sort of a set framework or thesis through which they try to digest information about, different opportunities. And, we can kind of hope that long shots kind of becomes a platform where things don't get lost in translation. We kind of talk about things more from a, looking at a business as an investable class. So basically three questions, right? What makes a business tick? What makes it scale? And what makes it stay in business as they scale? So with that in mind, we have with us Mr. Pankaj Parvanda. Pankaj is the co-founder and chief strategy officer at GhostOps, India's largest, if I may say so, youth hostel and travel brand, but with much larger aspirations. Pankaj, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you, Nikhil and Sharad, for having me on the podcast.
No, the pleasure is all ours. So Pankaj, would like to start straight into GhostOps from the standpoint of, what is it that you guys exactly do? I mean, obviously, we know about it from the standpoint of a user or a customer, but would love to understand a bit more about your model and, how you make money. That's yeah, as, straightforward as it can get from a question standpoint, obviously.
Yeah. So, Nikhil, basically, as you've already mentioned, GhostOps is India's largest backpacker hostel brand or youth travel hostel brand by the number of beds that we currently have. Although it's a very new segment that us and our other companies that have sort of started joined us in creating. So even though we're the biggest, but there's a long road for us to cover. Just to define the backpacker hostel or the youth travel hostel segment, these are essentially youth hostels that have existed in Europe for a long period of time. And then private players sort of gave it a whole new meaning with bringing in standardized amenities and operations and and bringing very high quality assets and services within the reach of young people whose affordability is significantly different from other demographics. So all of this revolution, while this happened in Europe in the last 20 years, India was still untouched by this privatization and overhauling of the erstwhile youth hostel concept. So just like India sort of skipped a lot of technologies and sort of leapfrogged into a lot of latest trends and revolutions, similarly, I think India sort of missed quite a few generations of the evolution of youth hostel. And in 2014-15 is about the time when young entrepreneurs such as us saw the opportunity in creating this class of youth-focused hotels, which would essentially be, overhauled youth hostels and bring in, high-quality sort of hospitality or hotel assets and services within the reach of the young audience, which we understand that their budget is less than 1,000 rupees a night, and there is just no accommodation in the country that services these people in less than 1,000 rupees a night. And there's clearly, a magic formula that we used in the youth hostel concept, which is the sharing economy benefit that comes with the youth travel hostel concept. We are able to monetize a room and divide it into multiple beds. And as a result of that, we're able to bring very high quality assets and services within the reach of young people. So just like the co-working revolution is bringing high quality office spaces within the reach of the young audiences and letting them dream, or the co-living revolution is bringing high quality living facilities within the reach of the young audience or the new age audience, there is no reason why they should still stay at dingy hotels. So even the hotels should use the sharing economy benefits of living in a community-based stay, which essentially is a youth hostel. And that's the category and the brand that GoStops is sort of leading the revolution with.
Because, interesting, obviously, you talk about positioning it to youth. Like, when we talk about youth, I mean, one angle is obviously the price point. You typically, there's an assumption made that when you're talking about youth, they're early on in their career trajectory, hence price point. A second thing you talked about is sort of sharing ecosystem, right? The price point appears to be fairly intuitive, but how do you sort of, what is the rationale or what is the data that you sort of know with conviction that, sharing is something that the youth wants and they are willing to travel under that mandate? Working is sort of, it sort of took off in a different way, but what are the suggestive factors? Is it sort of what you've seen in the West play out, any sort of extrapolated to Indian market and expect that sharing will evolve over time? Or is there any other salient feature that you've noticed or interacted with and that has come out clearly?
So in our journey while building GoStops, I wouldn't be brave enough to say that young people want sharing. Sharing is something that they go after so as to be able to drive efficiencies in these services and be able to afford much better quality of services that they want. But what they really value is community. So what they want essentially is a high quality asset being brought within their reach, and only a sharing concept or a sharing economy can bring that asset within their reach. But if one was to think that this is a pure sharing economy, cost-based price play, that doesn't seem to be true because dormitories have existed in India for a long time. If you go to Bombay today, you will see a dozen dormitories all over. And while they provide cheap stays to the economically weaker section, that needs sharing economy benefits to be given to them as well. But the youth has never sort of gone in large numbers and stayed at these dormitories, which have existed for a long time. Only till private players in 2014-15 sort of came up with a product which was centered around fostering social interactions in common spaces, designing furniture in a way that sort of it breaks the ice between multiple people, bringing in games and entertainment that sort of allows people to interact, bringing in events that sort of breaks the ice amongst people, and bringing in like-minded people, which is, of a particular age group, of a particular demographic, that sort of makes the community tick and interesting. And that's the reason that a young consumer who can actually get a dormitory bed in 300 rupees in Mumbai is currently staying at a GoStops property at about 90-95% occupancy with an ADR of 1,000-1,200 rupees a night. So it's all about, the social interactions and the other people staying at the hostel.
And that's the sweet spot of pricing that you guys had, 1,000-1,200 bucks, correct? Like around that point?
So I strongly believe that there is a large market which exists in the in the 500 to 750 bracket, and then the current audience, or the audience that were the quick movers, the early movers that came into our hostels about 4-5 years back, those guys I think have sort of have become more discerning hostel travelers and are now expecting a lot more amenities, and those guys today are pushing us to get even higher quality assets, in the hostel space. And which is what we are seeing, that in a lot of leisure destinations, our ADRs are already touching about 800,000 rupees. And then we are still seeing a niche segment of audience, which is asking for hostel stays at about 1,200, 1,500 rupees a night, you know, with a lot more open spaces, a higher quality of building and toilets, a lot more open, open spaces in that place, swimming pool, bar, and all of that. But while that remains a smaller piece to sort of go after, I think we are more committed towards serving people in the 500 to 750 and the 750 to 1,000 bracket. So with two or three sub brands, I think we should be able to address this audience.
Pankaj, very interesting. What does this segment look like in the sense that, you know, tastes and preferences change as people age, right? I mean, I think we ourselves probably, you know, the kind of, say, places one would go for food or for drinking or to party or to stay, like 10 years ago versus today, I mean, those choices have changed probably for each one of us. And I'm sure that also happens, that would also happen with your target group, right? And and there will be definitely a fine point in time where a sharing or a community-based living would stop being as attractive as it used to, right? And as their affordability goes up, as the wallet share changes, how do you address that? Or is it like it's a very big market in itself? So, you know, that kind of churn at the tail end of it doesn't really affect anything. And every year, newer and newer, you know, people within that bucket are adding in. So, like in terms of net additions, it doesn't really act as a factor. How do you kind of define your target group?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right that preferences and aspirations change with age, and a young person who just about sort of gets over with their 12th class in school and is going into college, I think that's the time when people sort of start traveling on their own, and that's the time I sort of see a young person becoming our prospective customer. And then, you know, they spend about 3 to 4 years in college where they're living on pocket money and they have a lot more, aspirations to travel. And then they get into their early jobs, first or second jobs, and they move into a city, which might be their home city or not. Yeah. And then they make new friends. And again, they need, possible places to sort of go and have sort of experience travel. Within 8 to 13 hours of, traveling distance. I would assume that at about 27 years of age, that's when people can afford a lot more. People also start having relationships where they value privacy a lot more. And I would essentially think that there should be like a thin line at about 27 where people should graduate from, say, a dormitory at a youth hostel to a private room at a youth hostel, or maybe to a homestay or a B&B also. At least that's what I would do. But it seems like today's youth is a lot more, a lot more willing to stay at hostels a lot longer. We've been wanting to put an upper age limit at about 35 years, because we didn't want to turn away too many people. But it seems that there are so many people who are 35 to 40 years old who are sort of, protesting and saying, no, we want to stay here. But all of this is coming from the fact that there is no other, this whole category doesn't exist in India. So there is a potential actually for a youth hostel brand or a social hotel brand to service people in the 30 to 40 year old bracket also. But because that social hotel does not exist, we have to take that responsibility and service people all the way from 18 to 40 years, which is what we're doing now. But tomorrow, hopefully, the social hotel category will also come up, and then we can lay complete focus on the 18 to 27 year old bracket. But that's the audience that excites us the most.
Right. So,
go ahead, Nikhil.
So no, Pankaj, what exactly is it that GhostOps is doing? Are you like aggregating inventory, supply, putting quality standards, helping young people discover, assets in offbeat locations where they can kind of get the community experience? Or are you guys way more hands-on? You are kind of into operations. I mean, I'm sure there are various models out there. Which one do you follow and why?
So our aim is simple. We just want to bring, like I said, sharing economy benefits and a community-based stay. We want to give a great youth hostel, travel hostel experience to young people in India. Now, to be able to do that, this inventory does not exist in India. So if we were in Europe, maybe the opportunity really lay in upgrading existing youth hostels, standardizing them, aggregating them, making some great hidden youth hostels discoverable, etc. But given the stage in India today, this new inventory needs to be created, which means someone needs to go and either build buildings or take up existing buildings and convert them into youth hostels. And then in India, there isn't enough proficiency or enough knowledge about how a youth hostel should be operated for young Indians, because it's still a new concept, both from the supply side and the demand side. And both the audience is still sort of adjusting and, letting us know what changes they would like to the global template and what new innovations they would like for us to sort of introduce in the product. And the hotel owners or the building owners are still sort of understanding this new concept and the benefits that sort of get passed on to them also, because of the efficiency gains that come to hotel owners also. So because of the complexity that is special to the situation in India right now, which is that this inventory needs to be created and both supply and demand stakeholders need to be handheld. So that is why we feel that in the initial 5 to 10 year period, for us to be able to really have this category blossom and have this category sort of quickly reach, an escape threshold, an escape velocity, it is very important for someone to handhold have a full stack operator model to handhold every single bit of the value chain. So that is the reason that after experimenting with multiple business models, such as franchise operated, franchise owned company operated, franchise owned company managed, company owned company operated, we sort of decided that whatever the model be, company operated is very important in the initial few years for this category to really flourish. So today, we essentially expand our hostels, or we create these hostels for young people using two models, which is company-owned, company-operated, and a franchise-owned, company-operated, which essentially means that, like I said, you have to create hostels in India, and the way to create hostels is to go and either build a new building or take an existing building and convert. So we said, there is this great asset class, which is called the long-tail hotel supply, which are hotels which are between 20 to 40 rooms, less than 40, 50 rooms.
Right.
There are about 350,000 keys in that asset category. We said that's like, existing 3.5 lakh rooms, which are existing in the country. All we have to do is we have to just sort of transform those rooms, add the bunk beds, add the recreational facilities that young people need, and create hostels out of them. So we go and we convert these hotels into youth hostels, and essentially we operate them. Now, the only way to convert is either the company invests, capex required to be able to convert this hotel into a hostel, which is called a COCO model, or we ask the asset owner to invest that capex and give it to us to operate. But nonetheless, we operate.
But if I just, pause you for a minute, when you said there is a huge supply of 20 to 40 room small hotels, there are around 3.5 lakh keys. What's their pain point right now? I mean, how do you convince them that, don't do what you are doing, transform this into a hostel model, we'll help you. Obviously, we have the expertise. But what's the pain? Are they not able to sweat this asset as of now? I mean, aren't there budget hotel brands who are kind of catering to them in one way or the other? I mean, what exactly is the pitch that you give them?
So let's first understand, who are these people who own these hotels? These small hotels that we're talking about, which are 20 to 40 room hotels, are essentially owned by SME business owners.
Right.
And these SME business owners are obviously very good at the business that they run, because that is how they made the money. And to be able to sort of invest that money is when they invested it in this real estate class and they built a hotel.
Right.
Now, earlier, you know, there was a certain level of operational excellence that the traveler wanted or desired. And the SME business owner who owned this small hotel was able to deliver it with minimal intervention. However, the traveler audience within the country has evolved over the last 10 years, say from 2005 to 2015. And so has transparency about, you know, or the information asymmetry about how well are you delivering your services to the satisfaction of the consumers that are walking into your asset.
Right.
Now, because of the, you know, because of the migration of a large chunk of bookings from offline to online, because of the emergence of online travel agents. Now, today...
So these are guys, you know, just for the benefit of our listeners, these are guys like the Make My Trips and the Booking.coms of the world, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. So two things have happened, which is that the Indian traveler has become more discerning and wants better quality of, you know, services at the hotel, which means more intervention. Earlier, you could get away with lesser intervention. And second, if you don't give that 100% intervention that this discerning customer needs, then then the customer has enough information before he lands at the bus station or the train station and walks into your hotel. He or she sees that hotel profile online and just rejects you and doesn't come to your place at all. So today, you know, any benefit of being at a central location is lost if you can't deliver great service. So high intervention is hugely required today if you want to make that investment that you made into that asset category successful. So the real pain point of these SME business owners who own these small hotels is that they need a professional operator to come and operate this hotel or do the high intervention job which is required and deliver great service and earn great reviews for the hotel. And that is only possible if a professional operator has scale and technology and obviously professional services to their sort of side. And that can only happen once you have enough scale. So devoid of, you know, any professional operator available to these asset owners, they essentially want a hotel operator brand to come and operate this particular asset category. And it's very unfortunate that the budget hotel category does not have any operators who want to operate assets of 20 to 40 rooms, because it requires a whole new way of thinking an operating company, a hotel operating company, to operate this asset category, which is very different from, say, the assets that the Lemon Tree or Sarovar hotels of today, you know, operate, which are 50 to 100 room categories. So we are sort of reimagining that operator. And obviously, while we do it, we're going after a very niche demand sort of segment. And we have a differentiated value proposition. And we also have, a lot higher efficiency that we can drive into this asset class because of the sharing economy benefits of our model. And hence, we are able to lure a lot more hotel owners, not just because of our operator proposition, but also because of our significantly higher returns that we can deliver to them. And that is how we convert these hotels into hostels.
So Pankaj, like just to understand the payoff for the asset owner, right? So how is it typically structured? Is it like a lease arrangement that you have? Is there an upside kicker that you sort of give the asset owner? Or what is a typical discussion? Or is an average operator just happy that, you know what, like I'm anyways not getting good occupancies. You guys are going to drive up. I'm happy with the standard templatized lease payment. Like how does that payoff structure typically work?
Yeah, so the hotel owner is anyways happy that they have a professional operator who's committing to giving them a fixed lease payment for a 15-year or a 20-year period, which is like a lot of stress off their chest.
Yeah.
So that is definitely there. But besides that, like I said, our intent is to incentivize and motivate as many hotel owners to convert their hotels into hostels because we want to paint the entire town with our brand colors, right?
Yeah.
So essentially, you know, one way is to give them a percentage of, you know, the additional revenue that we'll be able to generate. But that requires for them, for the hotel owners, to have a lot more confidence in the model that we're speaking about, right?
Yeah.
And maybe it may be better if I was to sort of ask them to share a certain risk on the demand side with me once I have a few more hotels, you know, across the country. So today, You know, because we are so confident about this model, we actually build in that delta into the fixed rental itself, and we give a much higher fixed commitment to these asset owners, and we still make you know, significantly we make some very good gross margins on our hotels as compared to the rest of our sort of you know, other competitors and other sort of operators of hotels. Even after paying significantly higher rent, we're able to make very good gross margins on our hotels.
So, like, in terms of, like,
is your typical tenure for these lease agreements? Because they seem pretty good. Like, they seem friendly for you guys, right? Like, that de-risks a little bit. What are sort of other provisions, like walking out of the lease agreement? Is there a risk there, sort of, typically?
So while ideally we would like to sign an even longer sort of a lease tenure of say 25, 30 years, which is possible in bigger assets. But what we have found is that the sweet spot or the comfort of small hotel owners usually lies between 10 to 15 years. So we stick at this sweet spot of 10 to 15 years where both the parties are comfortable. And also the transformation capex that we invest in this particular building usually has a life of 10 to 15 years. So it sort of fits in together, because when we're asking the asset owner to invest that transformation capex, we're also giving them an assurance that we are going to sweat this asset for the next, you know, 10 to 15 years, which is the life of the asset that they're
investing. Which is how much is the average capex, transformation capex, just to get a sense of the numbers?
Average transformation capex is about 50,000 rupees per bed. So usually the conversion ratio is 1:5, which means if you're converting a 20-room hotel into a hostel, a 20-room hotel will get converted into a 100-bed hostel. And a 100-bed hostel will mean 50,000 rupees transformation capex investment per bed, which is about 50 lakh rupees.
Understood. And, you know, this is just to sort of understand, or, you know, we are not sort of VC guys, but, you know, I suspect, like, the kind of VC conversations we have or we hear, you know, a lot of people will sort of paint a broad brush and say, like, guys, you're very ops heavy and you're capital intensive. Now, who's putting in the capital, how the capital is, it's just moving across balance sheets. But is that something, like, you think about? Because, you know, typically when you look at startups, you know, there is that whole narrative of hockey stick and steep growth and all. This is sort of a more measured control. You're talking about company operated in the beginning to, you know, it's a trade-off between control and scale, and you're sort of maintaining that balance. Like, in your eyes, like, if someone says, like, guys, this is ops heavy, which we get, but this is a very asset heavy business. Like, what is your sort of view on that?
Yeah. So ops heavy. Definitely, we are ops heavy. And a lot of investors, I think, ask me that, you know, this business is so ops heavy. There are just so many touch points, et cetera, et cetera. And I have sort of deeply, gone into this question and tried to answer it for myself. And I have found that, you know, when I started thinking of businesses that were not ops heavy, unfortunately, I wasn't able to come up with any business which was not ops heavy. I know it seems like, you know, you're running a hotel, that's like a lot of work. Well, the fact is that, you know, even Zomato doesn't just get its premium, you know, without doing any work. There's a lot of work that is involved there in Zomato. Making the app, making the UI, UX of the app is just one part of the job. But managing the entire delivery fleet, optimizing that entire delivery fleet, that's where the business is. That's the premium you and me pay for, you know, getting that food from that restaurant to our place. And that's like a very ops heavy, you know, business. So I have not found any business where the consumer is willing to pay a premium till you're ready to get your hands dirty. So you know, ops heavy, that's my answer. On the part of capex heavy, well, that's absolutely right. Today, you know, our capex efficiency would be 1:1. You know, if we were to invest $3 million, we'd be able to get to an annual revenue of $3 million. Or if we sort of, you know, go up to our, say, first 100 hotels and we invest, say, about, you know, $7-8 million, we get to an annual turnover of $7-8 million. That's capex efficiency of 1:1. But what really has to be looked at is that after getting to your first 100 hotels and after really establishing this new category in the country, that's when you sort of unlock capital efficiency in this business, because then your capital efficiency is zero. You don't have to invest any capex. There is this large pool of asset owners which are really wanting for an operator to come and operate their assets and sweat that asset for them. And, you know, the amount of money that they have already invested in that asset is at least 10 times the transformation capex that you're expecting them to invest in that asset. So you're expecting them to put a delta of 10% on that asset. And you're saying, hey, I'm going to take all the stress off you. And you know what? I'm going to operate it for you. So if one has to sort of, if one was to look into this, then all that is required is, say, settle with a capital efficiency of 1:1 for a year. And then the delinearity and the sort of delinear capital efficiency really kicks in. And it's as a capital efficiency business as any other internet business, as any other brand business. Essentially, what we are a brand. You would be amazed to know, you know, one would think that, you know, we're a hotel business and we should be categorized as a real estate business. The fact is that the cost of, and even though when I told you that we pay, we have almost 90% of our supply in company operated models, where we pay a rent, fixed rent to our, you know, first 100 asset owners, and that to a premium over the normal hotel operation, you would be amazed to know that the real estate cost today for us is only 20% of our full asset base. So if we were really a real estate business, like a co-living company is, or a co-working or a restaurant in the mall, then our real estate proportion would be 40, 50, 60%, you know, of the entire cost structure. Real estate is just 20% of the piece. The rest, all of it, is just brand play. The consumer is willing to pay a premium or walk into a GoStops hotel, irrespective of its location in Nainital or irrespective of its location in Mukteshwar, because he or she trusts the brand GoStops and expects, one, it speaks to their aspiration and lifestyle, but second, they sort of trust that brand to give them a certain standard of predictable stay experience wherever they walk into. So it's essentially a consumption brand story rather than a real estate story.
You know, I'll delve a bit more into the ops heavy point. I mean, I totally understand, you know, in terms of the quality and in terms of the experience and the standardized offering that comes by actually getting into the ops, right? That's control, right? And obviously with that control, the price that you might pay is that, yeah, there's some sort of an operational risk that comes with it. And to your point that, there's an entire thing, right? That Amazon is not really a e-commerce company. It's a logistics company, right? I mean, that analogy can be applied to most of the tech-centric businesses out there. But like within the, within the hospitality space itself, right? I mean, if suppose we say compare you guys to a conventional hotel brand, I don't think there is any, you know, I mean, I don't think one can punch any holes in the thesis from that standpoint. But I mean, within the so-called new age models of hospitality, there are franchise operated models as well, right? Which kind of the idea is to de-risk yourself from the ops end there. And there are then those, there are aggregation plays also, which are even one level above that, right? Which are just kind of aggregating the demand end and then leaving rest to rest of the supply to figure out and rest of the experience to. And I'm sure you guys also must have experimented or considered at some stage, to look at a purely franchisee-operated type of a model, because it just helps you expand way more aggressively. And I'm assuming in your competitive universe also, there must be a few guys who are doing that, right? So what kind of made you, what was the validation for you? Was it that, a lot of the asset owners were like, look, I mean, this is not our core. We can't, if you expect us to operate, we can't, or if we are, it's not resulting in anything, very positive for the end user, and it's affecting the kind of money that we are making on the business. How do you kind of, square that? Because within the hospitality model itself, there are so-called quote-unquote ops light models, right?
So within your statement, you said, it might be faster to scale if you were to go with a franchise-operated model, or a franchise-operated model may be able to scale much faster. Now, that may be true for a budget hotel sort of a scenario where there is enough budget hotels in this country who the customer doesn't know which one to pick out of the whole lot. And so scaling with a franchise model may be quicker. But in our case, that is untrue. Why it is untrue is because it is not a an inventory which is existing, right, and you just have to sort of aggregate and bring.
Right.
You have to create this inventory, you know. So Zomato can only aggregate and or sort of deliver food to you only when there is enough food options that exist around you. You know, if there aren't, then you really have to get your hands dirty and open dark kitchens and open enough internet brands to be able to really aggregate them on internet. So in our case, this understanding that maybe you can scale faster with a franchise operated model is what I believe, right, because that is what is happening with our competitors who have chosen to expand with a franchise operated model. They're hitting a bottleneck on the supply side because the real pain point of the asset owner is that, hey, will someone please take this asset and operate it? Because I'm not even able to operate and give my 100% to operating a budget hotel here. Forget about learning a whole new model and going after a whole new audience. So one. And second, when you're going with a new concept, this guy is already, sort of struggling with an existing concept. And then you're saying, hey, will you invest another 50 lakhs? And you know what? The entire supply, the entire demand, as well as operational risk is completely yours.
Yes.
Then, you know, this is a little unfair, right? Yes. So you've got to put confidence on the table. You've got to bring confidence in the market. You've got to first, invest in building confidence amongst these asset owners. Show them enough proof points that these hotels are running very well. Build capabilities so that you are not at the mercy of asset owners alone, but you have strong operational backbone and understanding of operation of these hotels. And then, obviously, once the category sort of reaches escape velocity, like I said, and there are a zillion hotels which are getting converted into hostels, and you have enough expertise into how these hostels should be standardized and run, then you may choose any of the models to go with, as long as you stay true to your purpose towards the consumer.
Right.
Do you see any risk from sort of more established brands like the Lemon Trees of the world to sort of come downstream and dabble in your price point, not on a shared basis or not sort of the hostel network, but just to hit that price point and offer like a private room at 6,000 bucks a night? Or, you know, I'm saying Lemon Tree, but there might be other guys out there who are sort of more established operators. Is that, do you see that as a risk, or, you know, that's probably not such a big risk because you're dealing with a completely different kind of mindset? You're sort of creating a hostel brand and that's still a hotel. It's a cheap hotel, but it's still a hotel. And second is, like, yeah, how do you sort of view that? Is that a risk, or like, do you see that happening?
So that's the answer was there in your question. You said it's a cheap hotel. It's not a cheap hotel. It's a very expensive hotel. The person who stays with us and actually spends, say, 1,000 rupees for a bed a night is, you have to remember, is sharing that room with 8 other people, right? So that person is actually giving us an ADR of 8,000 rupees a room, which a Lemon Tree or a Sarovar is also not able to make on a lot of, you know, asset that they operate.
Hmm.
So one, it's not a cheap hotel. And all of this is not because we've gotten an 8,000 category asset, but it's because of the brand that we are, because of the operations that we are able to deliver, because of the lifestyle aspirations of the consumer that our brand is able to speak to for this particular consumer. So it is for that reason that we are, you know, able to command ADRs higher than everyone else. Now, if it is not a cheap hotel, then the only way to deliver a high quality stay experience to anyone in less than 1,000 rupees a night is to go after sharing economy. Without sharing economy, it's not possible. So then that means Lemon Tree or Sarovar or any other hotel operator, if they really become serious about serving people in less than 1,000 rupees a night, they will have to use a sharing economy model. And if they decide to do that, I think that will be the best moment for us, because it will accelerate the adoption of the model so much, by 1,000 times, and it will become so much easier for us to be able to convince asset owners to go in after for sharing economy models and even from the demand side, I'm sure these partners will also invest a lot of money in marketing, will sort of join hands in sort of reaching out to more young audience or more audience that is, you know, wants to stay and is looking for hotels in less than 1,000 rupees a night. So I think the day they sort of decide to go after sharing economy models, it will be a really great day for us.
What are the typical unit economic standpoint? What are the margins in, say, one room typically that you can get at a gross level?
So, I don't have to tell you that for every business, you know, unit economics and gross margin are evolving numbers, right? Even for RIL.
And let's say average occupancy number, just to get a sense of what the unit economics are like,
And fortunately for us, the unit economics are only sort of being driven upward as we are sort of expanding more and more. You know, we imagined to sort of operate at an ADR of 500 rupees. Today, our ADR has reached almost about 800 rupees. And our ADR is significantly getting pushed to the new assets that we're sort of signing. Our ADRs are going all the way up to 1250 rupees. So that's how, you know, these ADRs are sort of really getting driven. Because whichever asset category we sort of go to, or the envelope that we push in terms of the asset, bringing this a new class of asset to this consumer, they're just lapping it up because they're just so underserved. So we're still sort of figuring out, you know, how many assets we need in 1250 ADR category, how many assets we need in 1000, and how many in 750 ADR category. But usually, with irrespective of whichever sort of ADR category that we go after, usually we have found that we are able to operate these hotels at about 40 to 45% gross margin, net margin actually, which is after taking out all unit operational costs. And the rest is used to be able to fund our central expenses, because there's a significant amount of effort that goes in, you know, maintaining people who run these hotels in terms of the central HR team, the central finance team, central technology, to be able to disseminate all of the information. We have, you know, significant investments in learning management systems, HRMS and whatnot. So today at about, we are at about 2,700 beds. And at about 2,700 beds, we employ about 500 people. So there's a team of 500 people that the company sort of employs, and about 100 people are in the central team, while 400 people man the rest of the 2,700 beds that we operate. So the 40% gross margin funds the salaries and also the profits for the 100 people at the center.
Understood.
So, Pankaj, I mean... I guess, you know, when, if I were to ask you, like, what's your, you know, that question, what's the moat here, or what's the differentiator here, or what's the USP here, right? I mean, I can see that there's obviously a great amount of value that comes to the table from the standpoint of having end-to-end control and end-to-end, visibility on the customer experience. Would you characterize that as the single largest differentiator in your offering?
So I think for every business, you know, the ultimate moat is the customer service that you deliver, right? You know, even if you build a brand that people trust, if you it may take 2 years for you to be able to lose the trust of your people as compared to 6 months, but essentially you have to keep delivering, on consumer expectation every single day, right? So operational excellence and operational efficiencies, I think, are the moats in this business, which lead to, you know, strong recall in the consumer for the brand, strong willingness to pay a premium for the predictable experience that you get with the brand, etc. But what happens while you scale is that with scale, you get a lot more operational efficiencies, because of which you are able to deliver much higher quality services within the budget of the consumer. So you're able to deliver higher value to the consumer because of the scale, sheer scale. And you're also able to deliver a significantly higher value to your supply stakeholders.
Right.
So with the scale will come the efficiency mode, operational efficiency mode, which will allow us to deliver higher rents to our asset owners than any other hotel operator, and command much higher ADRs and occupancies from our, and NPS, net promoter scores, from our audience, just because of the sheer scale at which we will be able to operate.
Do you believe that there's that very anecdotal kind of premise which often comes, that in India, because there's a lack of very high quality homegrown brands, the appetite of Indians to pay a premium for a good quality brand is way more than what you see outside? Do you see that? I mean, within your personal experience?
I don't know. I can't compare it to other countries because I don't have data in terms of how Europeans are willing to pay for a Europe homegrown brand or Americans are willing to pay for an American homegrown brand. But at least from my experience, I have seen that Indians have a huge appetite and a huge sort of, and with all of this Atmanirbhar Bharat and Make in India campaign and, you know, go vocal, local and all of that, these are essentially resonating, the increasing self-affirmation of the new age Indian audience, right? So the Indian audience definitely feels a lot more comfortable with staying or, you know, consuming a homegrown brand and appreciates it a lot more. And I think the same is true vice versa also, because the homegrown brand is a lot more closer to the consumer and understands the nuances of the consumer a lot more. We are able to deliver a lot more value to the consumer.
Right. You know, me and Sharad, we often joke that, you know, there are lots of startups, you know, some of them are pre-revenue, some of them are, you know, post-deck. You guys, obviously, with 2,700 beds and 500 people on your payroll are way beyond that. And that's always a very, you know, that's a very fresh, I would say, and a refreshing kind of a proposition that comes.
And we are a bit positive.
That was exactly my next question, you know, in terms of path to profitability, how do you view things and where you are? Obviously, you are being EBITDA positive at this scale and at this early in your journey is impressive enough. But like, is profitability something like, do you need like, you know, that typical thing where is profitability something that you can predict where you are? Is, you know, in terms of the kind of margins that you get, like in terms of the stability of that margins, like do you have enough internal indicators to say that now I know that if I hit this much of business, I'm gonna make money at the bottom line? Like are you there yet, or is that something in the future?
No, we're pretty much there yet. We are already a bit positive, and I think at least say for the foreseeable future, both I and Pallavi, my co-founder, intend to sort of use EBITDA positive as a guardrail while growing this business. You know, when you're in early stages of growing the business and you sort of suddenly get access to a lot more capital, you can easily go aggressive in terms of expanding. And then a year and a half or 2 years later, when all the capital is finished, you may be sort of in a tough situation. And then you don't know how to maneuver this ship and, you know, which costs to cut and how to sort of find the path to profitability. But I think if the purpose of the business is, from a first principle basis to make profit, then I think at all points of time, if a promoter or an investor or any stakeholder does not have the clarity or the vision towards profitability, then that's a big sort of, alarm there. So at all points of time, I think it is very important, even if you're not profitable, at all points of time, you should have a very clear short-term, medium-term vision to profitability. Because what if the capital was to dry up? Can you quickly, within 6 months, drive the company to profitability? So we use EBITDA positive that vision to profitability as a very clear guardrail while growing the business. Because at no point after 6 months, after we have added 2,000 beds, do we want to be caught off guard and say, hey, Pankaj, how do you drive this company now to EBITDA positive? And I'm like, oh, I don't know what monster I created. So it's very essential that, you know, the monster should be in my control. I should know every single nut and bolt that moves the monster. So that's always, that's like the first principle that I and Pallavi follow. If we don't understand it, then we don't do it. We must understand, you know, which lever are we pulling and what is it going to lead to. So we are always in control of profitability at all points of time.
Interestingly, I think with Russia bombing Kiev, you're definitely, this is definitely the popular view, amongst the investment community. Probably 2 years back, you were in minority if you would have said the same thing.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But I guess, you know, this should actually be true at all times.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, right? Because we were also kind of from an investor ecosystem standpoint, Sharad, I think you follow Twitter more closely than I do. I mean, the number of tweets which suddenly was talking about being prudent and being, you know, having a razor sharp eye on profitability and cash flow generation. If we kind of, you know, map it against, you know, on a timeline basis, probably from January of 2022 onwards, those tweets from the VC community definitely exploded.
Yeah, there's been a definite, yeah.
And by no means do I intend to ask any promoter to not burn cash. Don't get me wrong. One has to burn cash to be able to, you know, build a certain scale that sort of supports the costs associated with giving a certain level of service to the consumer. All I'm saying is that at all points of time, even while you are burning cash, either you should have the reserve to be able to, you know, sustain that negative cash balance and sort of get to the point of profitability, or you should have, so you need to have either clear visibility of resources or clear visibility of, you know, or sort of being profitable when the resources end. That's all I am saying.
And, you know, Pankaj, like I was reading earlier this week that from January to July, like the general demand in the hotelling industry has been up like 60%. For rooms, and the supply has gone up by only 1-2%, which makes sense to me because you're coming off a lower base and low occupancy. But when you look at some of these stocks, right, Ind Hotel is up 68% through this year, which is a massive jump for a big name. Lemon Tree is up 57%. Mahindra Hotel and Group is up 17%. EIH is up 32%. Like, there is clearly a narrative, the public markets are clearly saying that this is an upswing in earnings for all the hoteliers, you know, be it from non-bed revenue, bed revenue, whichever angle you want to see. And which makes sense because you're coming off a very depleted base, right? So when you sort of see that, right, I mean, it's obviously a good time to be in this business, but does your mind say, oh, a lot of growth happening, let me open up more properties? Or does it like, hey, a lot of demand, let me jack up my prices? Like, there is a margin versus scale, you know, decision that one has to take. Like, what do you typically see is the ideal way to piggy ride this curve, right? Like, what do you think makes sense?
So in terms of, you know, increasing the prices and maximizing revenue per square feet, I think that's something that's inherent to, you know, all limited shelf life businesses such as hotels and airlines. So our pricing is never a fixed pricing. It's always done by a revenue management team, yeah, which sort of knows the city demand or demand for the particular product at a point of time and will always price the product to maximize revenue from that limited shelf inventory. So that is not even in our control. It is, you know, it automatically happens and the market sort of corrects our prices with demand. In terms of the question between whether you know, one sort of focuses on, so I think before the question about whether to scale or to drive profitability, I think another important point that I'd like to make is that it is not just that we are coming off a depleted base and that is why the hotel companies are doing well. One also has to note that overall the human behavior has changed after COVID. I think you know it, I know it, Nikhil knows it. We have become different human beings than we were in February 2020, right? We are a lot more concerned for our mental and physical health. We are, you know, sort of trying to achieve some sort of work-life balance, et cetera, et cetera. And that has led to more consumption of health and wellness products, et cetera, et cetera. Travel is another wellness product. And you can see that in the numbers. People are traveling a lot more. People are taking, and specifically leisure travel. Business travel has still not recovered to the pre-COVID levels, but leisure travel has skyrocketed like crazy. People are traveling a lot more. People are taking more vacations. Today, because of the hybrid sort of a work culture and, you know, being able to go to office a few days of the week and being able to work remotely a few days of the week, the lines between weekend and weekdays has gotten blurred. So earlier, a leisure destination would only see spikes in the weekends and then weekdays would be completely empty. That's not happening. People are taking longer vacations or even taking vacations on a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday just because a little lower rate is available.
And Pankaj, this you are saying, adjusting for the fact that like people probably are not traveling overseas as much and domestic travel in general has gone up. So this is adjusting for that.
No, I think people have started traveling overseas quite a bit, but those are not our audience.
In any case, right.
Does not travel abroad. Right. So you know, homestay businesses, premium homestay businesses who were sort of gaining from the tailwinds of, you know, luxury consumers not traveling abroad are maybe facing headwinds now.
Yeah.
But that's not true for our consumer. Okay. Our consumer
So something structural has changed for your consumer.
Nothing has changed for our consumer. Our consumer just sort of has made it a part of their habit to and has made a commitment to themselves to travel a lot more. And that is that can be seen in the numbers and is willing to pay a lot more for, you know, their wellness and is willing to sort of pay more to stay with a brand that they trust, that they feel will be more hygienic, will be more, you know, sort of safe to stay at. And the premium that they're willing to pay as compared to an unorganized inventory has increased as compared to pre-COVID. So that has happened. Now, the question about whether one, seeing the fact that this is a great time to be in hospitality, do you choose to sort of just grow aggressively or sort of drive profitability? I think one has to treat this time just like we treated the times of, you know, during COVID or pre-COVID also. I think even during COVID, you know, one would say that it is not a good time to expand. We actually used the COVID time to expand the most. We grew almost 6x during the COVID period because there were assets which were available at very good prices at that point of time. And it made a lot of sense to be able to get those assets in our particular category. Similarly, I think today also, while ADRs are rising, I think one has to stay prudent about driving profitability over the long run. And hence, one should not get too excited about the higher ADRs in this financial year. I think it's very important to sort of take it with a pinch of salt and take these assets up on very realistic numbers rather than, you know, on the aggressive numbers that one is seeing today. So I would, I think it was Warren Buffett's statement, right? Be fearful when everyone's going berserk and go berserk when everyone's fearful, right? So I think that is very true today also. During COVID was the best time for a value investor to actually invest and make money. And today, because everyone's going crazy and you're seeing these high rates, I think right now is the time to be very careful.
You know, typically, hotels or hospitality in general, you know, like airlines, they are an interesting beast, right? I mean, not a lot of people understand them. And there's that entire, you know, thing that effectively, you know, with the overheads that such an industry attracts, you know, every unoccupied room or every unoccupied seat on a flight always has a cash outflow that goes with it, right? So there's a lot of investors struggle to understand this particular asset class. If it was for you, like, I mean, obviously, you know, you kind of, you've raised a bunch of money and, you know, you have a set of both, I would say, strategic HNIs as well as angel groups, as well as, you know, quasi-institutional guys. And, with you know, based on a lot of conversations that you must be having with them, do you see within the Indian ecosystem a particular bucket of investors who get what you are doing? Like, I'm trying to think that, you know, like, if you look at, like, say, a typical vanilla-style venture capital firm, I mean, our initial impression might be, you know, it's a 50-50 chance that someone like that would totally appreciate, you know, an asset class like hospitality. And if you say compare it to, say, a real estate-focused fund, in your case, you yourself mentioned that, yeah, we can think of hospitality as a real estate play, but in case of GhostOps itself, real estate is, at the end of the day, a small part of the overall picture. I mean, it's important, but it's not the entire thing. So how? So if you were to, like, you know, look at buckets of investors, who do you think are you know, ones who might understand what someone like GhostOps does?
So you know, like I earlier mentioned that you know, one has to sort of peel the layers and find out what this business really is, right? So like I said, only 20% of our cost base is real estate cost. that's probably how much rent a tech business pays for their offices, you know. So we pay our hotel rents just like a tech business pays their office rent. So we clearly can't be categorized as a real estate business. But like I said, at the core lies the promise to the consumer to give them a predictable quality of stay, whether we deliver it to them through a company operated model, a franchise operated model, a company invested model, franchise invested model, the consumer does not care. Yeah. The consumer cares, can you give me a predictable service? And do you speak to my lifestyle aspirations and my travel aspirations? So essentially, what it really is a brand consumption play. So any VC or private equity investor who wants to understand the nuances of the Indian youth consumer's consumption will be interested in this play. Right. If you can differentiate between, what is the difference between a red hotel versus a multicolored youth-focused colored hotel, then, you can understand this business. If you can understand what will possibly a youth have to gain from walking into a common area where there aren't separate tables and chairs laid out, but a big gigantic table in between, and is able to talk to the consumer, I think you'll be able to get this business. If you're able to understand, why is it young consumers are flocking to co-working spaces and feel a lot more comfortable in co-working spaces as compared to the hotels as a service model, which has existed for ages, you would get this business. So it's essentially a consumer business. If you can understand the nuances and the psychographic needs of this new age consumer, then I think one would be able to appreciate this business.
Hello, Pankaj. Thank you so much for being with us. It's been a great pleasure. And I would now, probably for the first time, request all our listeners to also hit the like and subscribe button or whatever button you see on the app, because it definitely will help us. And if you're a founder, please, and if you want us to drill down your model, just feel free to drop us a line on the email we'll put on the description. It's been absolute fun to talk to Pankaj as well as get a better understanding of the GoStops model. And this is Nikhil Arora, and along with me, it's Sharad Tupran signing off.